On May 14, 1904, a man arrived at a mission station in the Congo carrying a parcel. Inside were the severed hand and foot of his 5-year-old daughter. Her name was Boali. She'd been shot by a guard, dismembered, and eaten. His wife had been killed and cannibalized too. 83 people died in his village that month because they hadn't collected enough rubber. The missionary, Alice Harris, photographed the man, Nsalov Wala, staring at what remained of his child. That photograph would help bring down an empire. Between 1885 and 1908, an estimated 10 million people died in the Congo Free State. That's a death toll comparable to the Holocaust. More than Pearl Harbor, more than the Titanic, more than Hiroshima. And it was overseen by one man who never visited the place once. King Leopold II of Belgium called his project a humanitarian mission to bring civilization to Africa. He promised to end slavery and throw back the shadows of barbarism. Instead, he created one of the most brutal forced labor systems in human history, a system built entirely on rubber extraction. This is the story of how bicycle tires and automobile demand killed millions, of the journalists and missionaries who exposed the truth using photography as a weapon, and of the man who ruled from Brussels, grew fantastically wealthy, and died in his palace having never seen the crime scene. Leopold Louis Philippe Marie Victor was born in Brussels on April 9, 1835. His father called him the little tyrant. His mother thought his hooked nose made him deformed. He was shy, awkward, walked with a limp. Nobody expected much from him. But Leopold had an obsession, one that began long before he became king. Colonies. In his 20s, he traveled extensively through the Dutch East Indies, Ceylon, Burma, India, China, Egypt. Everywhere he went, he studied how empires extracted wealth from colonies. The Dutch system on Java particularly impressed him. Forced cultivation of crops contributed 52% of Dutch central tax revenues, 4% of the entire Dutch economy. In 1855, at age 20, Leopold joined the Belgian Senate. Immediately, he began urging Belgium to acquire colonies. His colleagues ignored him. Belgium was small, prosperous, content. Why did they need an empire? In 1860, Leopold gave his finance minister a gift, a paperweight inscribed with a message in French. It said, "Belgium needs a colony." He wrote to government ministers exploring possibilities in Africa, Asia, South America. Everyone said no. He once told Kaiser Wilhelm II, while watching a military parade, that there was really nothing left for kings except money. On December 10, 1865, his father died. A week later, Leopold II was crowned king of the Belgians. He was 30 years old, and he finally had the power to get what he wanted. In the 1870s, Central Africa was largely unmapped by Europeans. The Congo River Basin, 900,000 square miles of rainforest, was particularly mysterious. Then, between 1874 and 1877, an explorer named Henry Morton Stanley descended the Congo River, mapping its course. Leopold read Stanley's accounts with intense interest. On September 12, 1876, Leopold hosted a conference at his palace in Brussels. He called it the International Geographic Conference. Scientists, explorers, and geographers from across Europe attended. Leopold's opening speech was a masterpiece of humanitarian rhetoric. He spoke of opening civilization to the last remaining region of the globe where it had yet to penetrate, of throwing back the shadows still enveloping entire populations, of a crusade worthy of this century of progress. Then he said something that, in hindsight, was almost insulting in its audacity. "Must I reassure you," he asked, "that when I called you all here to Brussels, I was not motivated by selfishness? No, gentlemen. Belgium may be a small country, but she is happy and contented with her condition." Everyone believed him. Ferdinand de Lesseps, the man who built the Suez Canal, called Leopold's plans the greatest humanitarian work of this time. Leopold founded the International African Association, publicly framed as scientific and humanitarian. Privately, he hired Henry Morton Stanley as his personal agent and sent him back to the Congo. Stanley's orders were simple: establish stations along the river, secure treaties with local chiefs, make sure the treaties ceded sovereignty to Leopold personally, not to Belgium. Between 1879 and 1884, Stanley obtained approximately 450 treaties. Most of the chiefs who signed them were illiterate. Many didn't understand what they were signing. Some treaties were later doctored by Leopold's staff to include more favorable terms. But the world saw only the humanitarian facade. Leopold was bringing civilization to the Dark Continent, ending slavery, opening trade. Now he just needed international recognition. In November 1884, 14 nations gathered in Berlin to carve up Africa. No African leaders were invited. The Sultan of Zanzibar requested permission to attend. His request was dismissed. The Berlin Conference lasted 3 months. European powers drew lines on maps, dividing territories they'd never seen among peoples they'd never consulted. Leopold's representatives worked tirelessly behind the scenes. He'd already secured recognition from the United States, the first country to acknowledge his claim to the Congo. On February 26, 1885, the General Act of the Berlin Conference was signed. Leopold's International Congo Society was officially recognized. The treaty required him to maintain free trade in the region and work to end slave trade. He promised to do both. On June 1, 1885, the Congo Free State was formally established. Leopold II became its sole owner and absolute autocrat. The territory was 2.6 million square kilometers, 76 times larger than Belgium itself. The population was estimated between 10 and 20 million people. And all of it, every acre, every river, every person, belonged to one man. A man who would never visit it once. For the first few years, Leopold ran the Congo at a loss. Ivory exports provided some revenue, but not enough. He borrowed money from the Belgian government. He sold bonds. He waited. And then, in 1887, an Irish veterinarian named John Boy Dunlop invented something that would change everything: the inflatable rubber tire. In the 1890s, bicycles became a craze across Europe and America. Millions were sold. Everyone needed rubber tires. Then came automobiles. Global demand for rubber exploded. In 1895, rubber sold for about 3 francs per kilogram. By 1900, it reached 10 francs per kilogram. Prices had more than tripled. The Congo had wild rubber vines growing throughout its rainforests. Leopold immediately pivoted from ivory to rubber extraction. In 1891 and 92, he issued decrees nationalizing approximately 99% of the Congo and its resources. He created a concession company system. Private companies received territorial monopolies in exchange for giving Leopold a percentage of profits. The Anglo-Belgian India Rubber Company, known as ABIR, was founded in August 1892 with 250,000 Belgian francs initial capital. In the early 1890s, ABIR's shares paid out about 2 francs per share in dividends. By 1900, the dividend was 2,100 francs per share. That's a thousandfold increase in less than a decade. The profits were staggering. But rubber doesn't harvest itself. Congo rubber came from wild vines of the genus Landolphia, not cultivated trees like in Brazil. Congolese workers had to find the vines deep in the jungle, slash them, and collect the latex that bled out. The standard method involved slathering liquid latex on their arms, thighs, and chest, then waiting for it to harden. When they scraped it off, it took their hair and sometimes skin with it. An official in the Mongala Basin estimated that rubber collection required 24 days of all-day labor per month just to meet quotas. 24 days. That left 6 days for everything else: farming, hunting, family survival. In 1893, the systematic rubber collection system began in earnest. Rubber exports that year, 580 tons. By 1900, 3,740 tons. A 540% increase in 7 years. Leopold's personal profit from rubber between 1896 and 1905 was estimated at 70 million Belgian francs. In today's money, over $1 billion. But there was a problem. The Congolese people didn't particularly want to spend 24 days a month in the jungle scraping latex off their bodies. So Leopold created a system to motivate them. European agents were sent to establish posts in the concession territories. They surveyed villages and created censuses of adult men. The standard quota was approximately 4 kilograms of dried rubber per adult male every 2 weeks. Agents received a 2% commission on all rubber shipped. If production fell below quota, the agent's pay was docked. This created a system where brutality was economically incentivized. Leopold also organized a private army called the Force Publique. By 1900, it numbered 19,000 soldiers. By 1905, 16,000 African mercenaries, commanded by about 350 European officers. Only white Europeans could be officers, Belgian regular soldiers, plus mercenaries from other nations. The army consumed over 50% of the state budget. Force public soldiers were recruited, or more accurately, acquired, through several methods. Some were bought from chiefs. Some were kidnapped as children from villages and sent to Catholic missions for military training. All were required to serve a minimum of 7 years. Their job was to enforce the rubber quotas. If a village failed to meet its quota, punishments included imprisonment, flogging with the hippopotamus hide whip called the chicot, village burning, mass execution, and hostage taking. Leopold never officially proclaimed hostage taking as policy. Authorities in Brussels emphatically denied it existed. But the administration supplied each station with a manual that included instructions on how to take hostages to coerce local chiefs. Men, women, children, elders, entire families were imprisoned in stockades until their relatives brought rubber. In July 1902, one ABIR post recorded holding 44 chiefs imprisoned simultaneously. At two stations in 1899, death rates among hostages reached 3 to 10 prisoners per day. Per day. A British vice consul who visited in 1899 wrote that after the rubber was brought, the women were sold back to their owners for a couple of brass rods. Sold back. Like livestock. But the most notorious aspect of the Congo Free State wasn't the quotas or the hostages. It was the hands. European officers were concerned that Force Publique soldiers were wasting ammunition on hunting or keeping cartridges for potential mutiny. So they implemented a policy. For every bullet fired, soldiers had to produce proof it had been used to kill a person, not wasted. The proof was a severed human hand. Baskets of hands became the currency of the Congo Free State. Soldiers used them to make up for shortfalls in rubber quotas, to replace people demanded for forced labor gangs, to shorten their military service terms. More hands meant shorter service. Some soldiers were paid bonuses based on the number of hands collected. A Swedish missionary named A.V. Schoblom reported in 1897 that soldiers were rewarded with brass rods per basket of hands. One soldier told him the commissioner had promised that if they delivered plenty of hands, he would shorten their service. This created a perverse incentive. Soldiers sometimes fired at animals for food, then cut hands from living people to make up their tally. Survivors later testified they'd lived through massacres by acting dead, not moving even when their hands were severed, and waiting until the soldiers left before seeking help. Some units had a designated keeper of the hands. Hands were smoked over fires to preserve them for later presentation to officers. Historian Peter Forbath wrote that the baskets of severed hands, set down at the feet of European post commanders, became the symbol of the Congo Free State. On October 10, 1896, Congo State soldiers attacked the village of Bandikio Wajiko because the rubber quality was deemed insufficient. 50 killed, 28 captured. All bodies had their right hands cut off. All of them. In September 1899, an American missionary named William Shepherd was sent to investigate massacre in Benakamba country. Shepherd was the first black American missionary to the Congo. The locals called him Mundundam, the black white man. When he arrived at the massacre site, the tribal chief Malumba proudly showed him the evidence. Shepherd used his Kodak camera to document what he found. He counted 81 right hands cut off and being dried over fire before being taken to show state officers what had been achieved. He also found 60 women confined in a pen and evidence that bodies had been cannibalized. Mark Twain would later mention Shepherd by name in his satirical pamphlet King Leopold's Soliloquy. In it, Leopold complains about photography exposing his crimes. "The Kodak," Twain wrote in Leopold's voice, "has been a sore calamity to us, the most powerful enemy that has confronted us, indeed." Most historical atrocities reduce victims to statistics. 10 million dead. It's a number so large it becomes abstract. But we know some names. Nsala of Walla, the man in Alice Harris's photograph, staring at his daughter's severed hand and foot. Boali, his 5-year-old daughter, shot by a guard named Lekilo, dismembered, cooked, and eaten. Banjinganoa and Nsala's wife, shot by a guard named Mboyo, killed and cannibalized. 83 people died in Walla in May 1904 alone. 83. Because of rubber. Mola Eculite was a young man whose hands were destroyed by gangrene after forced public soldiers tied them too tightly and crushed them with rifle butts. Alice Harris photographed him too. Yoko was a child whose right hand was severed when his village failed to meet its rubber quota. He survived. His photograph also circulated internationally. Balengo and Lingomo, two more victims from Walla whose severed hands were brought to the mission by Nsala's brothers. The Roger Casement Report contains testimony from dozens more. A witness identified only as Yuyu described soldiers killing 10 children in the water as people fled. "They killed a lot of adults," he said, "cut off their hands, put them in baskets, and took them to the white man, who counted 200 hands. They killed my little sister, threw her in a house, and set it on fire." Another refugee told Casement about being forced deeper and deeper into the forest to find rubber vines. Their women had to give up cultivating fields and gardens. Then they starved. Leopards killed some when they were working in the forest. Others got lost or died from exposure and starvation. "We begged the white man to leave us alone," he said. "We said we could get no more rubber. But the white men and their soldiers said, 'Go. You are only beasts yourselves.'" These are the voices that survived. The ones who lived long enough to tell someone who wrote it down. For every name we have, there are thousands we don't. How many people died in the Congo Free State between 1885 and 1908? We don't know exactly. And that uncertainty is itself part of the crime. Leopold burned the entire Congo Free State archives before transferring power to Belgium. The operation took 8 days. He told Nade, "They have no right to know what I did there." The first census wasn't conducted until 1924, 16 years after Leopold's rule ended. It counted 10 to 10.3 million people. But we don't know what the starting population was in 1885. Historians call the early estimates only wild guesses. Most scholars estimate the original population at between 10 and 20 million. E. Morrell, the journalist who exposed the atrocities, estimated 10 million deaths based on a starting population of 20 million souls halved. Roger Casement estimated 3 million, but he himself called it almost certainly an underestimate. A Belgian commission in 1919 concluded that roughly half the population perished during Leopold's rule. Adam Hochschild, in his definitive book King Leopold's Ghost, settled on approximately 10 million, a death toll of Holocaust proportions. Where does that number come from? Not just direct violence, though there was plenty of that. In 1901 alone, an estimated 500,000 people died of sleeping sickness. Swine influenza killed about 5% of the entire population. Smallpox ravaged communities periodically. But these diseases were exacerbated by the rubber system. When men spent 24 days a month in the jungle collecting latex, they couldn't farm. Families starved. Malnutrition made them vulnerable to disease. The years 1899 to 1900 saw what contemporaries called a terrible famine. Entire villages fled into French Congo to escape. The birth rate plummeted because communities were too disrupted to sustain families. One historian estimated that in the Kuba region specifically, direct violence accounted for less than 5% of deaths. But that was just one region. The rubber provinces saw far worse. Was it genocide? That's debated. The United Nations definition requires intent to destroy a specific group. Leopold didn't want to exterminate the Congolese. He wanted to exploit them. The deaths were, in his view, acceptable collateral damage. But Raphael Lemkin, the man who coined the term genocide, called it an unambiguous genocide. And Adam Hochschild, despite his careful scholarship, wrote that while it might not technically meet the legal definition, it was certainly of genocidal proportions. 10 million people. More than died at Hiroshima and Nagasaki combined. More than the Armenian genocide. Comparable to the Holocaust. And for years, almost nobody knew. The first person to expose Leopold's crimes was an African-American historian and pastor named George Washington Williams. Williams was born in Pennsylvania in October 1849 to free black parents. At age 14, he ran away to enlist in the Union Army under an assumed name and fought in the final battles of the Civil War. After the war, he attended seminary and became a Baptist pastor. In 1880, he became the first African-American elected to the Ohio State Legislature. In 1882, he published History of the Negro Race in America from 1619 to 1880, considered the first comprehensive history of African-Americans. W.E.B. Du Bois called him the greatest historian of the race. In 1889, Williams arranged to write articles for S.S. McClure's Associated Literary Press. He secured an interview with King Leopold II. Leopold was very impressive in person, charming, eloquent, passionate about his humanitarian mission. Williams believed him. In 1890, with support from President Benjamin Harrison's administration, Williams traveled to the Congo to see Leopold's civilization project firsthand. Leopold was alarmed when he heard about the trip. He urged Williams to wait. Williams went anyway. What he found was widespread brutal abuses and slavery imposed on the Congolese. On July 18, 1890, from Stanley Falls, Williams wrote an open letter to His Serene Majesty Leopold II. It's been called one of the greatest documents in human rights literature. Against the deceit, fraud, robberies, arson, murder, slave raiding, and general policy of cruelty of Your Majesty's government to the natives, Williams wrote, stands their record of unexampled patience, long-suffering, and forgiving spirit, which put the boasted civilization and professed religion of Your Majesty's government to the blush. He wrote that Henry M. Stanley's name produced a shudder among the Congolese people when mentioned. They remembered his broken promises, his copious profanity, his hot temper, his heavy blows, his severe and rigorous measures. And then Williams wrote something that would echo through the next century. All the crimes perpetrated in the Congo, he wrote, have been done in your name, and you must answer at the bar of public sentiment for the misgovernment of a people. He called them crimes against humanity. This was 1890. The term wouldn't appear in international law until the Nuremberg trials, 55 years later. George Washington Williams was the first person to use that phrase in its modern sense. Leopold and his supporters publicly denounced Williams' charges. Privately, they spread rumors that Williams was a blackmailer or worse. A 45-page refutation was circulated in the Belgian Parliament. Even Williams's patron suddenly withdrew support. Williams had contracted tuberculosis and pleurisy during his Congo travels. He moved to England in 1891 to work on a book about colonialism in Africa. On August 2, 1891, George Washington Williams died in Blackpool, England. He was 41 years old. His reputation was destroyed. His book was never finished. He fell into almost complete obscurity. And Leopold's crimes continued for another 17 years. In 1900, a young shipping clerk in Liverpool noticed something strange. His name was Edmund Dean Morrell. He worked for Elder Dempster, a company that handled cargo ships traveling between Belgium and the Congo. Morrell spoke French, so he was frequently sent to Belgium, where he could view internal accounts of the Congo Free State trade. And he noticed something that didn't make sense. Ships leaving Belgium for the Congo carried guns, chains, ordnance, explosives, and ammunition. No commercial trade goods. No cloth, no tools, no manufactured items that could be sold or bartered. But ships returning from the Congo were full of valuable rubber and ivory. The value ratio was roughly 5 to 1. Morrell understood what this meant. If no trade goods were going to the Congo to pay for these products, then the rubber and ivory weren't being traded for. They were being extracted through forced labor. This wasn't commerce. It was slavery. Morrell discussed what he discovered with his employer. He was met coldly and dismissively. The company offered him an overseas promotion. Then they offered him a lucrative consultancy in return for his silence. Morrell refused both offers. In 1901, he left the company to become a full-time journalist. In 1903, he founded a journal called the West African Mail. He published his first pamphlet, titled The Congo Horrors. Then he published King Leopold's Rule in Africa in 1904, and Red Rubber in 1906. In Red Rubber, he wrote, King Leopold starts upon his Congo career by declaring that he has taken in hand a philanthropic enterprise. The whole of these vast sums are the proceeds of the rubber slave trade of the Congo, raised directly or indirectly from the unspeakable oppression, misery, and partial extermination of the native of Central Africa. Morrell's work began to reach people, but he needed more than economic analysis. He needed eyewitness testimony from someone the British government couldn't ignore. He was about to get it. Roger Casement was born in Ireland in September 1864. He made his first voyage to the Congo in 1883 at age 19, working for trading companies. Eventually, he joined the British Consular Service. In 1901, He was appointed British consul to the Congo Free State. On June 5, 1903, Casement left his consular base on the Lower Congo River and traveled into the interior. He later said he ceased to be a consul and became a criminal investigator. For 3 months, he traveled to regions of the Upper Congo, interviewing missionaries, traders, and Congolese survivors. He documented everything. On September 15th, he returned to Leopoldville and sent a telegram to the Foreign Office. "I have returned from the Upper Congo today with convincing evidence of shocking misgovernment and wholesale oppression." In February 1904, the Casement Report was delivered before the British Houses of Parliament. 60 pages with 20 pages of appendices containing individual testimony. It was well-structured, solidly factual, and detached in tone, which made the content even more horrifying. Casement described villages depopulated by 60 to 70% since the rubber quotas began in 1893. He documented the hostage system in clinical detail. "When I asked if it was a woman's work to collect rubber, he wrote, the official said, no. That, of course, it was man's work. Then why do you catch the women and not the men? I asked. Don't you see, was the answer. If I caught and kept the men, who would work the rubber? But if I catch their wives, the husbands are anxious to have them home again, and so the rubber is brought in quickly and quite up to the mark." The appendices contained testimony from Congolese witnesses. One, identified only as you. You, described what he'd seen. "As we fled, soldiers killed 10 children in the water. They killed a lot of adults, cut off their hands, put them in baskets, and took them to the white man, who counted 200 hands. They killed my little sister, threw her in a house, and set it on fire." The report caused a sensation. The British Parliament forced Belgium to set up an independent commission of inquiry. Between October 1904 and February 1905, Leopold's own commission investigated. They confirmed Casement's findings in every detail. Officials were arrested. One Belgian national was given 5 years for causing the shooting of at least 122 Congolese natives. But Leopold himself was never charged. He was a king. The Congo was technically his private property. What could anyone do? In 1904 AD, Morel and Roger Casement founded the Congo Reform Association. It's been described as the first large-scale human rights organization. Morel served as honorary secretary. They called each other by nicknames. Morel was Bulldog, Casement was Tiger. Their strategy was unprecedented. They would mobilize public opinion through newspapers, pamphlets, books, and political lobbying. But most importantly, they would use photography. Remember Alice Harris and her photograph of Nsala staring at his daughter's severed hand? Harris and her husband John had taken dozens of photographs documenting atrocities. Children with amputated hands, mutilated adults, hostages in stockades, the Chicot whip. The Congo Reform Association created what they called Congo Atrocity Lantern Lectures. 60 photographic slides presented in public halls. John Harris wrote that the photograph of Nsala was most telling. As a slide, he said, it will rouse any audience to an outburst of rage. The expression on the father's face, the horror of the bystanders, the mute appeal of the hand and foot will speak to the most skeptical. In early 1906, John and Alice Harris toured the United States. They presented their images at 200 meetings in 49 cities. The Lantern Lectures had something of the same public appeal as a modern rock tour. Thousands of people attended each lecture. In December 1906, the New York American used Harris's photographs to illustrate articles on Congo atrocities for an entire week. This was the first photographic campaign in support of human rights. the first time atrocity photographs were used to mobilize international opinion. Mark Twain joined the cause. In 1905, he published King Leopold's Soliloquy, a satirical pamphlet where Leopold complains about being exposed. Twain has Leopold say, "The Kodak has been a sore calamity to us, the most powerful enemy that has confronted us, indeed." Arthur Conan Doyle, creator of Sherlock Holmes, wrote The Crime of the Congo in 1908. He completed it in 8 days, fueled by burning indignation. "There are many of us in England," he wrote, "who consider the crime which has been wrought in the Congo lands by King Leopold of Belgium and his followers to be the greatest which has ever been known in human annals." The pressure mounted. The British House of Commons passed a resolution condemning the Congo Free State in May 1903. The U.S. Congress demanded an end to Leopold's rule. Leopold fought back with propaganda, but he was losing. The photographs were too powerful, the testimony too overwhelming. By 1908, he had no choice. On August 10, 1908, the Belgian Parliament voted to annex the Congo Free State. Leopold didn't go quietly. He negotiated terms. Belgium would pay 110 million francs to cover outstanding debts, 45.5 million francs for his building projects in Belgium, and 50 million francs as a personal payment to Leopold himself. A payment for surrendering a colony he'd extracted through mass murder. On November 15, 1908, the official annexation ceremony took place at Boma. The Congo became Belgian Congo. The worst abuses were officially prohibited, though exploitation would continue for decades. Before the transfer, Leopold gave one final order: burn the archives. All of them. For 8 days, fires burned as the entire documentary record of the Congo Free State was systematically destroyed. Every order, every report, every piece of correspondence that might reveal the full scope of what had happened. Leopold told his aide, "They have no right to know what I did there." Leopold spent his final year with his mistress, Caroline LaCroix. He'd met her in Paris when he was 65 and she was 16, a prostitute. He lavished her with properties and the title Baroness de Vaughan. She became known as La Reine du Congo, the Queen of the Congo. He once reportedly spent 3 million francs on dresses for her at a single store visit. With his Congo wealth, Leopold had built monuments across Belgium: the Arcade du Cinquantenaire in Brussels, the Royal Palace facade, the Royal Museum for Central Africa at Tervuren, the Japanese Tower and Chinese Pavilion at Laeken, 6,700 hectares of forests and chateaus in the Ardennes, all of it built with blood money. Leopold II died at Laeken Palace on December 17, 1909. He was 74 years old. He'd married Caroline LaCroix in a religious ceremony 5 days before his death, though the marriage was invalid under Belgian law. His funeral cortege passed through Brussels. The crowd booed. Even his own people knew what he was. Historian Adam Hochschild later wrote, "I would guess that he felt no guilt whatsoever about anything he had done in the Congo. I would guess that he was proud that he had raised Belgium's status in the imperial world by means of this colony. And that, most of all, he was satisfied at how rich he had made himself." E.D. Morel continued his advocacy work. During World War I, he became a leading pacifist and was imprisoned for 6 months in 1917. In 1922, he was elected Labour Member of Parliament for Dundee, defeating Winston Churchill. He died of a heart attack in 1924. Roger Casement's story ended more tragically. In 1905, he was made Companion of the Order of St. Michael and St. George for his Congo work. He never opened the parcel containing the insignia. In 1911, he was knighted for his report on atrocities in the Peruvian Amazon. Yes, it was happening there too. But Caseman had become increasingly involved in Irish nationalism. He helped organize the Irish National Volunteers. In November 1914, he traveled to Berlin seeking German support for Irish independence. In April 1916, he sailed to Ireland in a German submarine for the Easter Rising. He was arrested on April 24th. Convicted of treason on June 29th. And hanged at Pentonville Prison on August 3rd, 1916. In a letter written in the spring of 1907, Caseman reflected on what his time in the Congo had taught him. In those lonely Congo forests, he wrote, "Where I found Leopold, I found also myself, the incorrigible Irishman." Alice Harris lived to be 100 years old. She continued working with the Anti-Slavery and Aborigines Protection Society. When her husband John was knighted in 1933, she famously said, "Don't call me lady." In 1970, on her 100th birthday, she was interviewed by BBC Radio 4. She died November 24, 1970. Her photographs remain in the Harris Papers and Lantern Slide Collection, owned by Anti-Slavery International and managed by Autograph ABP in London. They're still powerful. Still unbearable to look at. Still necessary. The Congo Free State collapsed not because of moral outcry alone, but because of economics. Congo rubber was nicknamed red rubber, red for the blood of the Africans killed during production. But it came from wild vines that were being harvested to extinction. The system was unsustainable. Meanwhile, in British Malaya and the Dutch East Indies, something different was happening. Plantation rubber. In 1876, the same year Leopold hosted his Brussels conference, a British botanist named Henry Wickham smuggled 70,000 rubber tree seeds out of Brazil. They were planted in Ceylon and Malaya. By 1905, plantation rubber was becoming commercially viable. By 1910, it was cheaper than wild rubber. By 1914, plantation rubber accounted for 59% of global production. By 1922, 93%. The Congo couldn't compete. In 1890, Congo produced 850 tons. By 1900, 5,800 tons. Peak was around 1904 at 6,500 tons. By 1910, production had fallen to 4,800 tons. By 1922, just 800 tons. The horror of Leopold's Congo didn't end the rubber trade. It just shifted the rubber trade elsewhere. And those British plantation colonies would later attempt their own monopoly scheme. After World War I, rubber prices collapsed. British planters, now controlling about 75% of global production, sought price supports. In November 1922, Winston Churchill, then Secretary of State for the Colonies, enacted the Stevenson Plan. It restricted rubber exports from British Malaya and Ceylon through a quota system designed to drive up prices. Rubber prices tripled. The United States, which consumed 75% of global rubber, was furious. American companies scrambled for alternatives. DuPont developed neoprene synthetic rubber. Goodyear developed plantations in the Philippines and Costa Rica. Firestone developed massive plantations in Liberia. And Henry Ford decided to break the British monopoly by building his own rubber empire in the Amazon. That venture was called Fordlandia. It's another story of colonial ambition, hubris, and failure. Another story of how global commodity economics drove disasters that killed thousands and ruined millions more. The same rubber boom that fueled Leopold's atrocities from 1890 to 1908 set the stage for the monopoly schemes of the 1920s and Ford's Amazon catastrophe. Red rubber gave way to plantation rubber, gave way to monopoly rubber, gave way to corporate rubber. But the pattern remained the same. Power, profit, and human cost. In the center of Kinshasa, there used to be a statue of Leopold II on horseback. It was torn down after Congolese independence in 1960. But Leopold's buildings still stand in Brussels. The Arcade du Cinquantenaire. The Royal Museum for Central Africa. Tourists photograph them without knowing what paid for them. The museum at Tervuren still exists, though it was renovated and reopened in 2018 with exhibitions acknowledging Belgium's colonial crimes. But for decades, it displayed Congo artifacts with no mention of how they were obtained or at what cost. In 2020, during the Black Lives Matter protests, Leopold statues across Belgium were vandalized and removed. Some were decapitated. Others spray-painted with the words assassin and shame. King Philippe of Belgium wrote a letter to the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo expressing his deepest regrets for wounds of the past. He stopped short of an apology. The Congo Reform Association pioneered techniques that would be used by every human rights campaign that followed. Photography as evidence. Public lectures to build awareness. International pressure campaigns. Celebrity endorsements. These tools are still used today by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and countless other organizations. The phrase crimes against humanity, first used by George Washington Williams in 1890, became part of international law. It was codified at the Nuremberg trials. It's now a cornerstone of international criminal justice. But the most important legacy is simpler. We know their names. Nsala of Walla. Boali, his 5-year-old daughter. Banjinganoa, his wife. Mola Ekulite with his crushed hands. Yoka, the child who survived. Leopold tried to erase the evidence. He burned the archives. He died in his palace, wealthy and unrepentant. But the photograph survived. The testimony survived. The name survived. 10 million people died in the Congo Free State between 1885 and 1908. Most of their names are lost. But what happened to them is not forgotten. And the man who did it, the humanitarian who brought civilization, will be remembered for what he truly was. A king who never saw his crime, but couldn't hide from it.